Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 18th, 2011. It's hard to imagine how the people of Japan are dealing with the triple shock of earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear nightmare. They were arguably the most prepared nation on Earth, so what can we learn?
How many people prepare for what almost appears to be a once-in-a-lifetime event? I mean, truly, truly the height of catastrophe.
We'll review the basics of preparing your finances for the worst. And on an entirely different note, a conversation with Susie Orman.
I love saving money more than spending any day.
And she wants you to think the same way. Plus, some advice on talking with aging parents about their finances.
You've got to be honest about your own emotions. Your own emotions are the ones that stop you from going forward.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times this week about all the people who are suddenly calling contractors to get earthquake retrofits on their homes. We tend to ponder and acknowledge the worst-case scenario when we watch it happening to someone else. The rest of the time, we kind of pretend the risk does not exist. So, while we're all thinking about it, let's talk about how to disaster-proof our financial lives, or at least prepare as much as we can. The last time we talked with Candace Miller, the hills of the Angeles National Forest were on fire. She's the executive director for the Insurance Information Network of California. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I have to tell you, I hesitate somewhat to start this by addressing earthquake preparedness because, quite frankly, it feels like we've gone so far beyond that with what's happening in Japan. I mean, this is beyond earthquake. This is beyond tsunami. Can you prepare for something like what's happening in Japan?
How many people think about a 9.0 followed by just a massive tsunami with global implications?
And then nuclear problems.
On top of it. I mean, granted, Japan is going through just an unthinkable situation right now. And yet you can also see where their dedication to disaster preparedness, the most prepared country on the globe, It did pay off in many ways. I mean, the last thing in the world you want to do is discourage someone from preparing.
Well, let's start then with what lessons we can immediately take out of this, particularly when it comes to preparing ourselves financially for a disaster.
The beginning of that would probably be the old home inventory that we always talk about.
Right. In fact, you've been to my home and done that with me.
Yes, we have. And you saw how difficult an inventory can be, and especially think about it after the fact of a disaster, where you will be asked to compile what were your losses.
Right.
That is a good starting point for your financial plan as well. Sit down and take an assessment of your finances. How much equity do you have in your home right now? That's something you want to think about not only with your family, and that's very important, but also with your financial planner or your insurance agent.
What about your cash situation in an emergency? You know, I think people don't even know how much to have around the house because, as we saw in New Orleans, banks were underwater there. People literally could not go to an ATM machine.
We learned so many lessons from Katrina. Mm-hmm. And somehow you've got to be able to access that cash. So it almost goes to the old, you know, do you stash the cash in the mattress?
Right.
And
if so, how much?
You may have a place in your home where you want to keep, you know, at least a few $100s in case of an event like that.
What happens if you are unable to get to or do your job in the aftermath of a disaster?
Well, this is a part of a plan that your employer should have on hand. And in fact, it's a good idea to ask your employer, do we have a disaster plan? Do we practice this? Big employers typically do.
I can't believe I'm actually going to ask this question, but what kind of coverage, if any, is available for radiation?
Well, the thing that you wouldn't want to hear necessarily if you don't have any familiarity with the issue is that it's not covered in your homeowner's policy at all. The good news is there's a reason for that. It never has been by federal law. When the nuclear industry was emerging back in the 1950s, Congress acted to pass legislation called the Price-Anderson Act. And one of its mandates was that an insurance pool would be created by the nuclear industry, and it's funded to cover property losses, health damage, and personal losses.
Not being able to go back to your home.
Exactly.
Anything else that we need to be keeping top of mind at this point?
I think it's important not to be fatalistic. How many people prepare for what almost appears to be a once-in-a-lifetime event? I mean, truly, truly the height of catastrophe. But it should also reinforce the lesson that this should be part of a family plan to make sure that your family gets back on its feet after an event like this.
Candace Miller is the Executive Director for the Insurance Information Network of California. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Listen very closely, and you might recognize this voice.
Denied. You cannot afford it. All right, you are denied. You are denied to buy a Chanel bag. Are you kidding? You are denied. I'd rather see you carry money in a paper bag. I have to tell you, you are denied. Denied.
All right. You may think it's Kristen Wiig from Saturday Night Live, but no, it is the real deal. The diva of dollars herself, Susie Orman. She's just written another book called The New American Dream, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here.
Your newest book is devoted to the subject of the American dream and the fact that our concept of it has kind of had to change because the American dream as we know it just might be dead. What does the new one look like?
It looks like happiness, hope. It looks like you have a life where you communicate with one another because everything you're communicating with is the truth. You know, the old American dream was based on bigger, better, more. More house, more car, toys, all of these things. And that would have been an okay dream if we had the money to have paid for those things, Tess. So it's actually good that the old American dream is dead, because it was a dream that was based on financial lies. The new American dream, there is no debt. You live below your means, but within your needs. You get pleasure out of savings as much as you do in spending.
Wow, that's a lot of change.
Yes.
It sounds a lot like maybe we're just going back to a more realistic American dream of 20, 30 years ago.
I wish it could be that easy. You know, way back then, when you retired, you had a pension. Today, health insurance is going to be tremendously expensive. Social Security is being postponed and postponed in terms of when you can actually collect it. You're not going to leave a job with a pension because they don't even offer pension plans anymore. The new American dream actually is knowing how long you need to work in order to pay your bills. For most of you, it really will be till you're 67 years of age.
What do you think about that development in our financial lives, that so much of it is left to us now? You know, you mentioned we don't have a pension system anymore. You know, we have to now manage our own 401k retirement
yes.
plans. And we have to understand investments to be able to do that. Is this
yeah.
a good development or a bad one?
Well, we get into trouble because we think everything's going to be okay. Somebody's going to take care of us. We now live in a world where every one of us needs to be responsible for the money that we're making.
Even though you say we're living in a new reality, you take to task this concept of a new frugality coming out of the Great Recession. What's your issue with that phrase?
Well, it's that we're not really having to be frugal. We should just really live our lives where we take as much pleasure in saving as we do in spending. You should be loving the fact that you're in control of your money versus your money is in control of you. The new American dream is a dream where you stand in your truth, where if you have to say to your kids, I love you so much, but I don't have any money in retirement. I don't have an emergency fund. I can't even barely pay my mortgage. I can't afford to pay for you to go to school. Then the kids are starting to understand that they can deal with this because they know what to do then. If they're going to go to school, they need to take out a student loan. They need to know how much of a student loan they can take out. It's not about just being frugal. It's about being honest.
But when you talk about taking pleasure in saving, that really is a change of mindset. And behavioral economists have done studies that show literally pieces of our brain light up when we're spending, when we think about spending. So there's something in us that's wired to be much more excited about spending than we are about saving. How do we change that?
By simply changing. You know, I've always said, if you want to change, just change. Recently, I just did a piece. And
make
it was
it sound
shown
so
on,
easy.
Well, you know what? I have to tell you, it is. I love saving money more than spending any day. I rather eat at home than eat out in a restaurant because it makes absolutely no sense to spend that kind of money. Now, I have a lot of money. I am a very wealthy woman. And I worked for every penny of that. So I know what it took. I make choices where my money goes further. So I don't spend money just because I have the money to spend. Start having pleasure in saving money equal to that of spending. Can you do it? You absolutely can.
There was a lot of talk that more and more people were going to do that coming out of the Great Recession. But, of course, we're already getting reports of increased credit card use, things like subprime lending for cars. Do you really think that we as a society can change our habits permanently to become better savers than we are spenders?
I do. I do with every ounce of my being if we start talking about this conversation. 7 years ago, I met somebody from Washington, D.C., outside of the NBC Experience store with his mama here in New York City, where I'm coming to you from. And I started talking to this little boy about saving and putting his money actually in a savings account and what would happen. And they actually just showed this piece the other day on Nightline. They then brought him back. He's now 17 years of age. His mother, who is a single mother, did exactly what I said, and they now have enough money for Deontay is his name, to go to be the first one in the family ever to go to college. He will tell you he gets more pleasure out of saving than spending. But how did that happen? We started him when he was 7. So yeah, I never think it is too late to learn this message, but I will say this, the sooner you begin it, the better off you will be.
Susie Orman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
And you can find an excerpt from her book at marketplace.org/thebigbook. We had quite an extensive conversation with Ms. Orman, and we'll bring you more of it in a few weeks. We asked some Facebook friends how they're feeling about their retirement prospects. Scared, said one response. What retirement? Asked another. Well, the survey out this week from the Employee Benefit Research Institute showed confidence about retirement security is at its lowest point in 2 decades. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explores why.
The report says more than a quarter of U.S. workers aren't at all confident about retirement. 62-year-old Mary Akers is one of them.
There just is no hope for me to retire.
Akers bustles around her kitchen in suburban Maryland, ticking off her retirement regrets. She made good money in the 80s, but didn't save much because she got sick. She didn't think she'd get old. If she did, there'd be Social Security. Ah, the 80s. Big hair, shoulder pads, retirement.
The future was glorious, and then the 90s came, and now we're looking around and saying, what happened? Where's everything going? And we're looking at the health care and Social Security and just watching it all kind of fall apart.
Then came the financial crisis. Her 401k took a big hit. Stocks have recovered some, but Akers is still pessimistic. Jack Vanderhey co-wrote the retirement report. He says people used to just guess at what they'd need for retirement. Many have saved very little. More than a quarter of those surveyed have less than $1,000 socked away. Vanderhey says the crisis scared workers into actually setting goals for retirement savings. Now they're depressed.
The fact that more of them have gone out and figured out that my goal is X dollars and I'm not even close to X dollars has done a lot to decrease those overall confidence levels between 2010 and 2011.
Amazingly, the survey finds people aren't changing their habits. They're just planning to work longer. 74% of current workers plan to stay on the job past retirement age. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace Money.
And now time for your questions. Helping us out this week is MSN's Liz Pulliam-Weston. Hi, Liz. Hi, Tess.
I wanted to talk to you real briefly before we get to the callers about what people can do to help. Obviously, the situation in Japan is ongoing. And I think, you know, the big question for a lot of people is, what can I do?
Two words, Red Cross. Two more words, give money.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people want to give stuff, and that actually can be more of a hassle for the volunteers and the emergency workers on the other end. So
why is that?
Here's an example. I was in Alaska during the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Hmm.
And, you know, with the cleanup and the animals, people got it into their heads that we needed more blankets and towels for the cleanup. Well, container loads of linens showed up, and it wasn't what was needed, but people really wanted to help. So if you do want to help, you want to make sure that your efforts get the maximum bang for your buck, and that means giving dollars.
One of the concerns that always comes up, though, is, you know, these fly-by-night charities that seem to pop up and assure you that your money is going to get to where it needs to go.
Yeah, that's why I just default to Red Cross. There are other charities that you can look into, but make sure you do some background checks. You know, go to Charity Navigator and see if they've got a decent reputation before you give money.
Okay, so that's charitynavigator.org, and we will have a link to that on our website. All right, let's go to the phones. And Matt and Ashley are with us from Sugar Grove, Illinois. Hi, guys.
Hi.
So we've got both of you on the phone.
We do.
Ah, what's going on there in Sugar Grove?
Well, I just put somebody down for a nap.
Ah.
Yeah.
So why do we have both of you on the phone?
Well, because it's kind of a two-part question. My wife doesn't ever listen to the show, so she really doesn't kind of know what's going on.
Ashley!
But I do on my way home from work on Sundays, so I kind of ambushed Ashley with it. It's not really it's not really my thing. It's more of her thing.
What did you ambush Ashley with?
He's like, I'm going to ask these people about a financial question with money and everything, and you basically have to do whatever they say.
Well done, Matt. I like this.
Yeah,
this could backfire, though, Matt. You know?
Well, it could backfire quite badly, but I'm not sure yet.
Okay, so hit us with the question.
The question was, we have a substantial amount of money in our checking account. My wife has had it saved up. She had about $20,000 saved up when we got married. We got another $10,000 or so after we got married, and that money has kind of grown since then. Now we've got somewhere around $42,000, $43,000 in our checking account. We definitely make enough money for us to just get by without ever touching that money. So I kept saying to her, why don't we look at investing? Why don't we look at investing? Well, the closest thing I've gotten her to do is change our checking account and take some of that money. She took about $30,000 and we put it in a money market account because Ashley's reasoning, she wants to be able to have access to her money all the time.
Well, let's let Ashley get a word in edgewise.
Okay.
Here. Ashley, tell us the reasoning behind your decisions.
Well, my goal is in the next 3 to 4 years is to buy another house. And I'm afraid that if I invest the money, we're going to lose all the money. And then it's going to be starting all over again with saving again.
So it sounds like you're not really comfortable at all with the stock market.
Oh, no, not at all. My parents, I know that they invest a lot, and my dad keeps telling me, I lost $6,000 today, or I lost $10,000 this week. And it's I don't want to, put all our money into something and then have us lose it all.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, as far as having an investment for only 2 or 3 years, I don't really see the big reward. Maybe if it was a retirement, that would be fine, but my goal is not retirement right now. It's, buying a house in a couple of years.
Right. Well, first of all, your goal should always be retirement. Wouldn't you agree, Liz?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, Ashley, I totally understand and actually probably will be coming down more on your side. But I need to know what you guys have saved for retirement.
I think we have about $30,000 with my husband's. I currently stay home right now and raise our baby. But he has about $30,000. He takes 6% with his TSP and they match that.
Okay.
And then,
that's the government thrift savings program.
Right. Correct.
And he is also eligible for a pension?
Yes, he is.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's...
I get 40%, I think, or 45% of my base annual pay, plus whatever I've put into my TSP, and they've matched.
Okay, so it sounds like you're pretty well on track. You feel pretty comfortable with that?
Yeah, and I'm an air traffic controller, so in my opinion, I guess I have reasonable job security.
Okay, so what about Ashley? What have you got for retirement?
I don't have anything because I quit my job in September, and then I just took whatever money we had. I think I only had $2,000 for my retirement, and I put that into our savings.
You cashed it out?
Mm-hmm.
No, 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 no. Ashley, don't do that. No, 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 no. Okay. This is not directly to your question, but we'll get around to it. Ashley needs retirement savings of her own. And mm-hmm. you guys are in a fortunate position. I'm going to assume that over time you will continue saving. You will continue building your finances.
Mm-hmm.
Probably be a really good idea to set up a Roth for her.
Okay.
Instead of prepaying a low-rate tax-deductible debt like a mortgage, I would much rather see that money go into a Roth for her so that it can grow over time.
Okay.
And that she will need to take a little bit of stock market risk, Ashley. I know you don't like it, but if this makes you feel any better, over time, over every 30-year period since 1928, stocks have eventually returned 8% annually. That's the average return. So even if you got into stocks right before the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
where stocks, you know, lost 90% of their value, if you could hang in long enough, you know, you would get back to having a positive return.
Okay.
Pick up a book like Investing 101. Kathy Kristoff wrote that. Investing for Dummies. It's got an insulting title, but it's really easy to read.
Okay.
Maybe get a little bit more comfortable with the investing side.
How old are you guys?
I'm 25.
And I'm 28.
Okay, so you've got a lot of room to take a little bit more risk with your money, particularly for money that you're not going to take out for another 50 years.
Okay. Sure.
So let's then get to the question of this emergency account where they've got money sitting and really not doing a lot for them, as pretty much any savings vehicle right now is not going to do a lot for you. What about this debate over what to do with that money? Frankly, I think Ashley has a point that if you're going to be needing that money in the next 2 to 3 years, you probably don't want it in the market.
Exactly. Sure. That's the key, is to look at your ultimate goal and match the investment to that. And if you're going to be tapping that within 5 years, definitely don't put it in the stock market. In fact, I wouldn't put anything in the market that you're going to need within 10 years.
Okay. So with that in mind, the best vehicle for our money at the moment, if we're going to say we're going to be looking to buy another house in 3 years, because right now a money market account is what we have it in, I think that's like 0.015% or something.
Yeah, but that's what you're going to get with pretty much anything but the market right now.
Well, you're going to do a little better, actually, if you go to an FDIC-insured online bank, and here you have the security.
You're going to get 1%?
You're going to get 1% instead of a fraction of a percent. At least you can move it and get a little bit more return, and that's something that Matt can do so he can feel like he's actually taking action. And it's still going to be something that's completely accessible. You can get to it at any time. Now, it sounds also like this is kind of not just your housing fund. It also sounds like this is serving as your emergency fund.
No, we have like two parts of our checking. I have money that we put in every single month for the savings, but I think we have an additional like $15,000 that's in our checking fund. So we have about like $45,000-$50,000 in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
We would like to maybe have like a $300,000 house, and I'm planning to have almost like $100,000 in 3 years just by saving and everything like that. So
we love you.
I love Ashley. Oh, heart, Ashley, heart. Matt, do you realize how lucky you are?
Oh
my gosh.
I know. I know. And I've said this since day one. My wife can pinch a penny so hard a dime pops out.
Oh, I like that one.
My kind of woman. This is great. Okay. Now that we know that, you know, this is not an emergency fund, because I was under the misapprehension that you might need to tap this. Okay.
No.
You probably won't. Then maybe you do want to look at possibly CDs. And what you can do is a ladder so that you have CDs of different maturities. Money is always coming up in case you do have to tap into that.
Mm-hmm.
You get a little bit more return. Right now, I mean, everybody's wondering when are interest rates going to go up. So I wouldn't lock everything into one long-term CD, because almost certainly you're going to be able to get better rates down the road a bit.
Okay.
All right. Great question, you guys. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you.
And next we have Chad, and he is in Chi-Town, Chicago. Hi, Chad.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Very well. And you?
Pretty good. Can't complain. Spring's just around the corner, so we're all excited out here in the city that tulips will be coming out soon. So
very good. Has everything melted enough for that to happen?
Maybe a few more weeks. That blizzard really left a nice footprint for us. So
yeah. What do you do there in Chicago?
I am a treasury analyst. So I work on day-to-day banking operations and cash management, settling for a large corporation here.
Well, then why on earth would you need us?
Well, I had a question. My wife and I have an 8-week-old boy.
Oh, second family in a row.
Yes,
with a little bundle in the house.
Oh, yeah. My question is in regards to setting up his college fund and other insurance information. We got his Social Security card in the mail,
mm-hmm.
and we used it to submit these forms online. And like I said, I'm not sure if I'm just coming off as slightly neurotic, but His Social Security number is now out in cyberspace, and you know how the media continues to report about all these banks and other institutions having all these Social Security numbers absconded due to security breach or negligence?
Yep.
Is identity risk something I need to monitor with him?
Well, first of all, I don't think that we can blame any new father for being neurotic. In fact, I would say we applaud you for being that.
Exactly.
Oh, good.
Good for you.
You know, Liz, we do hear stories every once in a while about, you know, identity theft from a two-month-old baby.
Yeah.
That somebody opened a credit card in the name of, well, not just a baby, but sometimes a cat or a dog.
Yes.
So, A, how much of a concern should this be? And B, if it is a concern, what do you do?
The sad fact is the kids that are most at risk are at risk by family members. This is the dad that takes the Social Security number to establish credit somewhere, the mom that goes off and gets utilities. So that should give you some comfort. You know you're not going to do this to your child.
No.
Right, Chad?
Right. <not.
laughs> Okay, so part two of that is there is a slim risk of stranger identity theft. But
okay.
The problem is that you can't go to the credit bureaus and ask for your son's credit history because probably there won't be one. If this is a concern when he's, you know, getting into his teenage years, the ID Theft Center down in San Diego has a wonderful website, and they have the procedures you have to go through as a parent to request your child's credit report if there is one.
But, I mean, I guess the question for Chad right now is how much does he need to worry about it in the immediate future?
Yeah, I don't really think there's a huge risk. If the number is ever really compromised, you'll probably get a letter and saying, you know, the number has been compromised. So you should follow up on that. But for most parents, especially at this stage in life, it's really not a huge risk.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the tips. That really helps me.
Well, hopefully it'll help you sleep a little better?
Yeah, let's
maybe.
Hope so. Especially my wife.
All right, thanks for the call, Chad.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, and finally we have Deborah in Alloway, Michigan.
Alloway, that's right. You got
is
it right. Yeah.
Alloway?
Alloway.
Okay, hold on just a second. Boys and girls, I have an important call. Hey, you must be quiet.
What do we have going on behind you there?
I've got a little kindergartner class leaving.
Oh, my goodness.
And I have a second grade class coming in just a minute, too. So
oh, my goodness.
I may be a little distracted. But anyway,
wow.
I'll do the best I can.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll try to make this speedy for you. How long have you been teaching?
Oh, I've been teaching for 15 years.
Wow, yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, I'm an art teacher. So I see all the kids in this school, which is 750 a week.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get right to your question. How can we help you out?
I got a phone call one evening, and this guy said, I represent the law firm of, and I can't remember exactly the law firm's name, and he says, I'm a mediator. Someone is suing your son.
How old is your son?
And my son is 30. And so I thought, well, what's going on that I didn't know about, you know?
Oh, no.
You, as a mother, you just, like, worry, you know? And he says, oh, this happened some time ago, but I'm sure it will be all right because I'm a mediator, and I bet if they can talk, they can work it out. So I go, well, okay. So I did get a hold of my son.
And what did your son say?
My son goes, what? And he, well, the first call I got back first, though, was this man calling back and saying, your son hung up on me. He doesn't sound very cooperative, and we're going to start garnishing his wages, and we're going to, and I thought you were a mediator.
Right,
and
All right. Liz, this sounds to me like a bill collector gone wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, then my son calls back, and he says, you know what this is? He says, this is a Discover card from 2 years ago, and it was a $250 limit Discover card. Can you imagine?
Not actually, yes, I can.
Yeah. What's happening is a lot of law firms are getting into the collection business. The problem you've got, obviously, is there's Fair Debt Collection Practices laws. There's federal law, and then there's state laws. Debt collectors are not supposed to misrepresent themselves as to what they're doing or what they're about. They're also not supposed to talk to relatives or neighbors or your employer about what they're calling about. You know, they can ask for contact information, but they're not supposed to be discussing debts. The issue is, even though it's a small debt, this law firm, you know, is threatening garnishment and lawsuits. So your son really needs to go talk to an attorney that's familiar with the credit laws in your state.
Okay.
You know, hopefully this won't be a big deal and you can, you know, he can bark back and scare them off. You might want to send this this company a letter saying, you know, stop contacting me, because you have that right under federal law and it does not affect, you know, you're not being sued. So you can basically tell him to go take a hike.
Would you encourage the son to go ahead and pay it off?
I have a problem with rewarding companies that are violating fair debt collection practices or that are on the line, you know, and being threatening. That's why I suggested go to the attorney, just see where you stand or see where he stands.
Okay.
He should be very cautious because firms like this tend to, you know, pile on fees and pile on interest and pile on all kinds of other things.
Well, yes, it's way more than 250 at this point, sure, you know.
Well, good luck and thanks for the call.
Thank you for having me on.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can email your question to the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz Pilliam-Weston, it's been fun as always. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tess.
And do remember to check with your own financial expert before making any big money decisions.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit squarespace.com/marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's squarespace.com/marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Millions of caregivers in this country look after an older family member. The AARP wanted to put a price tag on that service, and 4 years ago released a survey putting the value of family caregiving at a whopping $375 billion a year. But a growing minority of family members are actually being paid to do the job. Ashley Milne-Tite has the story.
David Fowler and his wife take care of his 94-year-old mother, Mary Ruth, a retired teacher. She was widowed in the 60s and lived on her own until a few years ago. But when her eyesight started failing, they moved her from Indianapolis to their home in Ogallala, Nebraska. David's preparing his mom an afternoon shot of caffeine.
Unlike most of the people who come from Indiana, who like colored water, she likes strong coffee.
He heads up to her room on the second floor.
Room service.
Oh, my goodness.
There's your espresso.
Very good.
Make your day.
Yes, indeed.
Mary Ruth is blind now, but she's still pretty self-sufficient. She climbs the stairs and dresses herself, although David and his wife Gloria lay out her clothes. She started showing signs of dementia, so they've taken her pills into their room, and they make sure she takes what she needs when she needs it. David says it's a joy to care for his mum, and he'd do it for free, but he doesn't. Mary Ruth pays her son $1,000 a month. It was his brother's idea.
At first, we were kind of uncomfortable with what he was talking about, because I don't want to make a profit off of my mother. That's just not in our way of thinking.
But the money is welcome. David will turn 70 next month. He and his wife both work part-time. For years, they owned a photo studio in town and plowed everything they made back into the business.
Well, as it turned out, digital really killed the small mom-and-pop portrait studio. And our business was worth maybe half of what we had anticipated when we sold it.
Some of his mother's payment goes towards running the house. The rest goes into savings. Everyone in the family wanted the arrangement. Nothing was put in writing.
Any client that I would counsel would not simply do it informally.
That's Howard Crooks, a lawyer who specializes in elder law. He's drawn up dozens of personal care contracts for family caregivers, and his business is growing. Crooks says it's about protection. There may come a time when the older person has to go into a nursing home, has very little money left, and should qualify for assistance from Medicaid. But there's a catch.
The monies that you pay to the family caregiver, absent an agreement in writing, will be deemed to have been gifted by you to the family caregiver, causing a period of delay which you will not qualify for the Medicaid benefit.
In other words, Medicaid may not pick up the tab for months or years because it looks on those dollars as money you could have saved to pay for your care. Eleanor Ginsler of AARP says people don't realize how fast their money can disappear.
If you do, in fact, go into a nursing home, two-thirds of people who are in nursing homes started out as private pay but ended up going through all of their resources and end up applying for that public assistance through the Medicaid program.
She says that's why it's important to have a signed contract before a family caregiver starts the job. Medicaid sees that as an employment agreement, and the contract should include all the details, exact duties, working hours, and compensation. And yes, both sides will have to pay taxes and Social Security. But that may be the easy part. Money is famous for causing family feuds. Howard Crooks has seen arrangements fall apart because one relative hated the idea.
They were, frankly, looking to have another family member provide the services in an unpaid manner so that more money could be left in the estate, and hopefully when the parent died, they would get more money.
That's not a problem in the Fowler family. For one thing, there's not much of an estate to leave. For another, everyone gets along, even if David teases his mother about the family hierarchy.
You always love me best.
That's what all three of you say. But there's no good, better, and best in this family. They're all best, at least to me.
They just take things day by day, enjoying a joke, a glass of wine, and each other's company. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Whether mom and dad end up paying you to help care for them, at some point you'll have to talk about their financial situation, or at least you should. But talking to your parents about money is as hard or harder than talking to your kids about it. So when is the best time to have the talk, and what needs to be addressed? Here with some answers is Carolyn Rosenblatt. She's a co-founder of AgingParents.com and author of the book Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
When is the right time to start this conversation with mom and dad about how they're doing with money?
Well, there's a rule of thumb some people like to use. There's no one set time, but I think if your parents are in their 70s and you're in your 40s, it's certainly not too early.
Then let's look at what the best way is to start that conversation, because it is not an easy one.
One of the best ways to get them engaged in any conversation is to start with a different subject. Get them talking about themselves. Get them talking about their lives. Get them talking about what retirement was like, whatever. And that opens the door to being able to ask some of the real questions.
Honestly, asking that question, mom and dad, how are you doing with your finances? I don't want to do that.
Well, no. Most people are very hesitant because money is an emotionally charged issue. And emotions are really what get underneath the conflicts that people have. And since I'm in the conflict resolution business, I can tell you that money is probably the most common issue that comes up in families and causes them to get into fights with each other. You've got to be honest about your own emotions. Your own emotions are the ones that stop you from going forward. They're emotions of fear and maybe being afraid of not having control are what stopped them from talking about this.
What do you do if the reaction you get after, you know, nicely and empathetically asking how the money situation is, what if the answer is, I've taken care of everything, don't worry about it?
Certainly you don't want to start out making a demand of your parents that they tell you about their money. I mean, beyond quietly thinking about how you want to relate to them and expecting that they're going to give you some pushback, you really want to tell them how you want it to turn out. For example, you might want to say, instead of tell me about how your money is doing, I hope we can have a talk about your future and how I can help. That would be a better approach. That's making a request instead of a demand.
Mm-hmm.
And we also come at our parents sometimes based on their past behavior. For example, if mom has never been comfortable with money and avoids money, and you know that, you might walk in and say, don't avoid this, mom. That's really telling her what you don't want her to do, and she's going to close down. And that's one of the things that makes conflict worse. So what we want to do is say something like, I'd like your cooperation, mom.
What do you need to know? What are the basics that you should be aware of as an adult child?
Well, we certainly need to know what their assets are. Do they have enough to live on? Are they going to run out of money, and are we going to have to pitch in? This is an all too common scenario because of longevity. People are living longer. They are outliving their assets. And their adult children don't know in advance and can't make any plans and they're caught unawares. And I think knowing what's available to support parents as they age, and especially to care for them, because that gets quite expensive, that's a very fundamental thing everyone needs to know. And another thing we all need to know, the obvious, is where is it? Where is the parents' money? Where are the banks? What are the passwords? What are the account numbers? Do they have the legal authority in someone else to sign paperwork and get into those accounts to help parents access their own money when they're disabled? These are essentials, fundamental things that we all need to know.
Carolyn Rosenblatt is the co-founder of AgingParents.com and the author of the book Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Kelly Whitmer. We are at Charlemagne Records in Five Point South, Birmingham, Alabama. This is my wallet. It's huge. It is a piece of small luggage. I have my ID, gift cards, cash. This is a coin that I got for being in recovery, so I hold on to this as well to remind me where I came from. I guess it's just sentimental because it takes me back to a hard time in my life that I emerged from. You know, it has the serenity prayer on one side, and on the other side it says, "To thine own self be true." And in my change purse, I have a fortune from a fortune cookie that I've had for about 8 months. It says, "There are big changes ahead for you." So I'm holding on to that, holding out for the changes.
When you gamble, you are just throwing money to the wind, right? Well, at least in places like, say, Vegas, there is a chance, the ever so slightest chance, that you will win some of it back. Outside of places like Vegas, no dice. But what if I told you you could use real money to place bets and never win, ever? Well, you'd say, why on earth would I do that, right? Here's Sean Cole.
It's called Double Down Casino. It's a video game application on Facebook. It makes noise.
There's a very flashy platform. It says you could play blackjack, slots, or roulette.
Slots are the most popular game.
And there are different ones. There's Wild Safari, Sunken Treasure.
I went with Sunken Treasure. It has a pirate theme. And it works just like a video slot machine in a real casino. Hit the button.
Glass. Skull and crossbones, cannon, skull and crossbones, pirate ship, spin.
Ah!
I won $20.
Now, initially you can play for free. You get a complimentary pot of virtual chips. But if you run out, you have to either wait until they top you off the next day, or you can put more virtual chips on your actual credit card. It's $5 for 600,000 chips, $39 for 75 million, which may seem like an absurd mountain of chips. But since they aren't real, some players will bet 20,000 virtual chips on one spin. And you may ask yourself,
how do I cash out?
Well, that's the interesting thing. You do not cash out in our game.
Greg Enell is the founder and CEO of Double Down Interactive, and he knows the law. Again, you can't run a gambling site in the U.S., and gambling, legally, has three aspects to it. Consideration, that is, betting, chance, and prize.
And what we've done is we have removed the prize element. So any money that you win in our game, you can never redeem that for any sort of monetary value.
So it's a bit like Hotel California. I mean, you can cash out anytime you like, but you can never collect.
Yeah, yeah.
Nonetheless, Double Down Casino is a Facebook hit. It launched last June and already has almost 300,000 players a day. Only 7 or 8% of them are buying chips, but Greg Enell says that's a lot in the online video game world. The company's profitable. In fact, it's hiring. And all because of what amounts to a giant one-armed bandit from which no money comes.
A lot of people are amazed by the fact that people will pay to play a casino game when they have really no opportunity to win.
I'm amazed by that fact.
Well, I think there's something to be said for the thrill of gambling.
But it isn't gambling.
But it is. What we found is whether you're playing for real money or fake money, that same tension still builds. So if, for example, I'm playing blackjack, when I'm playing the game, I feel my blood pressure go up a little bit. I sit up straight in my chair. And if I do win $1.8 million in one hand, I will fist pump and I'll be excited.
Do you think this sort of satisfies the same desire that gambling satisfies?
I do.
But, you know, somebody who really loves to gamble is not going to be happy unless they have the chance of cashing out a lot of money.
Sue Schneider runs eGamingBrokerage.com. She's been monitoring the online gambling industry since 1995. And while this kind of prizeless play is relatively new, she says it isn't exactly rare. Even some actual gaming sites offer a free play section where you can practice.
And without that factor of the money, people play differently. They're going to risk more. They're going to make decisions that they wouldn't make if they had $20 on the game.
People like Jim Pruitt in Columbus, Indiana.
Hello.
Mr. Pruitt.
How are you?
Who plays the slots on Double Down Casino every day after his night shift at an aluminum tube factory. So far, he's spent about $150 on virtual chips.
The more chips you play on a line, the more you win. So it makes you feel like you're winning more, you know.
And so that makes you feel like a high roller.
Sure, yeah.
In a way that you wouldn't be able to feel in real life.
Right.
And why not just play with the daily allotment of free chips?
They don't give you enough to sustain that high or the thrill or whatever you would call it.
So it's like a drug in a way when you describe it like that.
Oh, yeah, I guess it could be, yeah.
But it's really more like non-alcoholic beer.
That's a good analogy for it. It really is.
Thank you. You get a similar flavor, but you don't wind up all stumbly. That said, a few Double Down players, just a few, get out of hand with it, spending thousands of dollars on virtual chips. And when they do that, Greg Enel's company sends them a message.
And we essentially tell them that you are now a formal VIP, and anytime you need chips, just request them directly from our customer support group, and they will provide you chips at no cost so that you can continue to play the game.
One more spin!
I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
And you can go to marketplace.org/money to check out what personal finance blogger Barbara Friedberg thinks about gambling. That is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, we partner with the New York Times for a look at Money Through the Ages. It's a special report on how financial issues play out through the decades of your life, from your teens to your 80s.
The earliest memory of money that I have is of not having enough.
Money is not what rules my life, but I am, of course, concerned about retirement.
I am living on Social Security because I've always put all my money into my business. I can never retire. I will never be able to retire. Probably about every 2 weeks when the bills are due, that's when I get really worried.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narcisse. Our technical director is Josh Robeson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.